Welcome to Professor Todd Landman's podcast series. In today's podcast, Todd talks about human rights analysis and comparative politics, and whether it's possible to apply a rigorous and systematic approach to research and still produce outputs of public value.
The article, in a way, was inspired by several things. One is that there's a belief in social sciences that one should not use empirical methods to address normative questions. And the whole reason I do stuff is because I'm concerned about big normative questions. And so I take that head on as a starting point. And in this particular piece, I was concerned by two things that were personally part of my experience and my formation in my interest in studying human rights. And the first was I was working in a library at Georgetown University in the late 80s as a graduate student in a photographic lab. And a Jesuit priest at Georgetown brought in a roll of film and asked me to develop the pictures. And lo and behold, the pictures were from the murder scene in El Salvador, where Jesuit priests were killed in 1989. And not only were these pictures of the priests, but their maid and the maid's daughter. So guilt by association. These maids were unrelated to any political struggle. The priests were seen as objectionable to the state, and a death squad had come in the early hours of the morning to kill them. The other moving part of that story for me is that in the newspaper coverage in the New York Times, for example, of the event, you see priests laying face down in the lawn outside a university compound. But the pictures we were developing were graphic, unbelievably violent pictures and the results of quite horrible violence. And for me, that sort of instilled in me the very horrible things that one human being can do to another. And that's never left me. And my sort of quest, if you will, is to use research as a way of combating some of those dark sides of human nature, if you will. Many years later, I found myself in the northeast of Brazil in João Pessoa, which is the sort of easternmost point of South America in the South Atlantic. And we had arranged to take a trip into the countryside with a group of academics and another priest, actually. So we had a sort of, you know, an SUV full of sociologists, a political scientist, and a priest, and one of the children was with us as well. And we went out to the contested lands, the large plantation holdings where landless people movement, sort of activists, if you will, were occupying land. And their phrase was occupy, resist, and then produce. And you have to understand the situation. You have sometimes landowners with 4 million hectares of land, much of which lies fallow, and nothing's being done with it. This was seen as an opportunity for peasants without land to acquire land, to use the land, and ultimately get legal title from the government. For me, it was also the stark conflict between the landed property owners and those without land, and the landed property owners often hired their own private militias to repress the peasant movement. So you actually saw, with my bare eyes, I could see installations with weaponry. You could see the bullet holes in the walls in the villages, and you could hear the stories of people being shot at. And here I saw this sort of natural affinity between vast inequality, both in land and in income, and human rights abuse. And that became an inspiration for another study that I conducted.
You start by talking about the very term human rights and where it's come from and come to. Just talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, one of the challenges for us doing human rights research is that there are no agreed philosophical foundations for them. There's actually quite a lot of contestation around where human rights come from as a concept and where they're philosophically grounded. And there are three sort of main lines of argument. One is that they're grounded in an appeal to God, that we're made in God's image and therefore we have these sets of rights. And that goes right back to Aquinas. Another argument is that they're grounded in nature, that it's all part of the natural order, and therefore human beings have rights, and that's more within the tradition of Locke. And finally, others say they're actually grounded in reason. There are certain things that you and I could say to one another without even thinking about it. We don't have to analyze the question. We can just say torture is wrong, killing is wrong. And these are kind of what Kant called deontological statements. These are things that just naturally sound right to us without applying that kind of 2 + 2 = 4 analytical reasoning. And so God, nature, and reason are often seen as the three reasons why possibly we have these things called human rights. But from 1948 onwards, they're given express legal framing from the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights through a series of binding legal instruments from the 1960s onward. The world now is comprised of a kind of deeper and broader set of rights deeper meaning there's greater state participation in those instruments, and broader, there are more rights that are written out or articulated in the international law of human rights. So in a sense, expression has been given to them by human beings on earth, writing them down, talking about them, negotiating what the lists are, and legalizing them through the power of international law.
What would you say are the principal challenges that face political scientists like yourself, who are seeking to take a very robust, a very empirical approach to human rights research?
Well, the big problem is, and I've been criticized for this, do you dehumanize human rights by trying to analyze them using statistics and quantitative measures? So that's the first charge and the first worry. I turn it on its head and say there are certain things we can discover by using quantitative measures and statistics that you wouldn't know if you hadn't done that. And that adds value to the study of human rights in ways that hasn't been done before. So there are challenges around convincing audiences, readership, scholars, and practitioners that there is value in the quantitative approach. And I don't only do quantitative, but that's a good example of why. Secondly, I think there's a skepticism within the discipline of political science about human rights, because they are normative concerns and they come from the legal tradition, the humanities, etc., and they don't really have a place in political science. So it's a small field in professional political science, but a growing field. And I think that some of those challenges have been overcome. There's some philosophical disagreements that the positivism, if you will, that lies underneath a lot of modern social science is not compatible with the philosophical and humanistic origins of human rights. Mm-hmm. And I think some of those tensions cannot be transcended. But what we can do is count things in the world and look at the distribution in those things that we count and try to figure out if what we see in the patterns of abuse towards human beings are happening for reasons other than chance. And I think that's where the statistics comes in and tells us where things are happening in ways that are not consistent with just mere probability and chance. There's some intentionality there. There's some cause for why that's happening. And that lets us think carefully about power relations and the protection and promotion of human rights.
Now, the case of the Jesuit priest in El Salvador that you mentioned at the beginning of our podcast is a very good example of some of these challenges, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, first of all, there's the sort of dignity question of the victims themselves, that we don't want to disrespect what has happened to them. These were people who were committed to their faith. They were committed to spreading their faith. They were also committed to helping the poor. Interestingly, at this time in Latin America, the Jesuits had, some Jesuits, I should say, had embraced the sort of teachings of Second Vatican Council, which was this articulation of a preferential option for the poor. The priests would move and teach in Spanish rather than in Latin. They would give sermons in Spanish and try to develop ecclesial-based communities that would allow lay people to become engaged in church affairs and the faith and etc., but also to address problems of social justice, poverty, inequality. And of course, if priests were doing that work, they were seen as an enemy of the state. And there was a famous phrase in the civil wars in Central America that said, be a patriot, kill a priest. Now, there's nothing more stark than that in making that simple equation, right? Now, when we study this more systematically, we can then, you know, dehumanize it a little bit and say, well, these are, four or five instances of a killing. They're an extrajudicial killing. They can be investigated, but they can be counted and compared to killings in other countries. And then you start getting into this more social scientific approach, which is, what are the macro patterns in large-scale violations against human beings and human rights violations that can be compared across country contexts, and how do we explain that they're higher in one country and lower in another country? How can we prevent them in the future? And we start asking some of those more meta questions of the field of inquiry that we're engaged in.
And how did your work on Brazil shed light on these challenges that you've outlined as well?
Well, in Brazil, the thing that for me in the countryside was this stark sort of combat in the countryside. We saw the encampments, we saw the flags, we spoke to the activists, we also saw the landholders and some of the weaponry that is being used. You also see civil and military police vehicles, tanks, and other things driving around in the countryside. So there's a kind of live, real-time feel about the struggle. And when you go to the urban areas, you see the beautiful Copacabana beach and developed areas of Rio, and you just have to turn around and look to the hillside and see the favelas that have been there. These are sort of shantytown developments that have been there since the 1950s and 60s, when urbanization grew in that country. And again, the human story is one of the stark contrasts, the duality of development in the country. But the more systematic approach will then say, okay, well, how do we measure inequality in this country? It turns out that Brazil has terrible income inequality, terrible land inequality. How does Brazil then compare to other countries? And so we did a global analysis of inequality and human rights and found that Brazil's actually quite typically on the line, if you will, when you do a regression analysis. So it's one of those countries that is highly unequal and has severe problems with the abuse of civil and political rights. So it's a typical country. And so the hunch I had wandering around the countryside is vindicated and supported by a more systematic global analysis. And that allows me to develop theories and sort of observable implications for other countries.
So what does your research then tell us about this whole thing of comparing countries when it comes to human rights?
So the comparison allows us to think about what's the absolute level of abuse within a country, if that's a valid question. So can we use methods to talk about the state of affairs and conditions in a country and the absolute violation of human rights? But then we can also say, well, is that a pattern of violations that makes sense given other country conditions? And can we relativize in a way some of that? Because if you take a purely legal approach, you say every violation is wrong, and I'm not justifying any violation, but you could also say that some violations are more understandable under certain country conditions than in others. So in a country where there's massive poverty, there's problems with social justice, access to education and welfare, and then we see crime on the street and a heavy-handed response from the police that gets backing from the public to be heavy-handed, there's a kind of an understanding that comes from all of those variables working together that may compromise the human rights situation. And it's not surprising. That would be surprising in a very wealthy country that has the means to give people access to health, education, and welfare. So I think, interestingly, in the news, the whole Ferguson episode, here is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. It does have enough resource for people to have access to education, welfare, etc. And one would expect a well-trained, well-financed police force. And what do we see? We see problems in all of those areas that are producing some of these egregious violations of people's rights.
Just finally, Todd, and referring back to the title of your paper, is it actually possible then, would you say, to apply a rigorous morality to human rights research?
It's a good question. I think that's the point of the piece, is really to say we can use rigorous methods to address some of these moral questions, that we make moral statements that it's wrong to torture or it's wrong to kill people outside some sort of legal process without due process, etc. And yet we see it on a daily basis. So rigorous social science allows us to take that, what we see on a daily basis, analyze it systematically, try to explain why it's happening, while at the same time, if we understand why it's happening, we might be able to reduce it in the future. So that allows us to take a systematic approach to the promotion and protection of human rights.
Todd Landman was talking to me, Chris Garrington, about his research, Rigorous Morality, Norms, Values, and the Comparative Politics of Human Rights. In his next podcast, Todd will talk about his new free-to-download book, Human Rights and Democracy, The Precarious Triumph of Ideals. This series is produced by Research Podcasts.